Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, December 5th, 2009. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. Our topic for discussion today is Trash the British Global Warming Genocide and Look to the Indo-Pacific Frontier. I might subtitle this, The British Empire's Going Down. I'm very glad to have discussing this with me live in the studio today, Ramtanu Maitra, who is our Executive Intelligence Review New Delhi desk and often goes back and forth to India and to the United States and elsewhere. But welcome, Tanu.
Thank you, Marcia. It's glad to be here.
And from the other down under, we have Glenn Isherwood from the in Australia, in Melbourne, I believe, from the Citizens Electoral Council, from the LaRouche Youth Movement there. Glenn, welcome. Did I say
G'day,
Glenn
Marcia.
Isherwood?
That's right. Yep.
Very good. And well, I'll be giving out the website for Glenn's organization and effort in Australia, or we can do that in the course of the hour. But let me just begin by saying that obviously we've got the events are very hot and heavy right now in the world. You can see with the degree of complete collapse being manifest as it was some days ago in the so-called Dubai crisis. It's really like the crisis of Hong Kong during the opium wars, the dirty
right.
money drug center, which Tanu might get to. But the thing is, and we have many other examples of complete collapse of the monetarist imperial system. So the issue is going to be, are we looking ahead towards a new course, a pathway of development and hope, or if our forces for humanity don't prevail, doom in a dark age? But I think is, the good news is the impetus is shifting away. There are many strategic shifts in a positive direction. And I just want to refer, before we get deep into it, people to the LaRouche Political Action Committee website to review or see for the first time the December 3rd webcast that the LaRouche LPAC, LaRouche Political Action Committee, held out of Washington, D.C. internationally. I think it was called something, a Real Change Coming. And Mr. LaRouche looked ahead to what must be done in the United States in particular, but what we want to do in the world to forge a joint initiative by the major powers, the four powers, Russia, India, China, and the United States, towards initiating the credit system, the kinds of emergency measures and major infrastructure projects that can make literally all the difference on this planet. And I will add for people, look on the LPAC website, that's LaRouchePAC.com, for Mr. LaRouche's participation and also his wife out of Germany, Helga Zepp LaRouche, in a Moscow-based conference December 3rd and 4th, where each of them participated by pre-taped video. And the conference was against globalization. It was held by an association that's focused on that, and also I think the Academy of Geopolitics.
Oh.
In Russia. So we have what you might say when Mr. LaRouche taped something for this Moscow conference in November, his words were literally that the world has shifted from former domination, think of the globe, by the Atlantic Ocean as far as what goes on in the world, and now it's shifted across into the Pacific, into the Indian Ocean, with the nations of Asia and touching Africa, and certainly including Australia, that this is a new period we are looking at, where we can look towards developing the vast resources of countries of Eastern Russia, Siberia, Mongolia, and we can look for generations ahead. Now, you can find the exact quotes from his speech, but if you take this perspective, let's talk now, open the discussion in a kind of parallel two-track way, where I'd like to have Glenn start off and describe a singular event in Australia that took place against the British Empire and Commonwealth. And then right after that, Tanu, maybe speak of the orientation towards development future by China in its intrinsic. It's not as if there was maybe one singular.
Right.
Okay. So, Glenn, what happened this week? Tell us in Canberra.
Well, down here, there's been many ironic upheavals in these last few, this last week especially, but leading into last week, we've seen a massive shift coming from the population in response to this, you know, push for a Copenhagen Treaty and the policies associated with that. It's interesting, this past week, the Liberal Party of Australia, which is traditionally, if you look back in history, has been the pro-monarchy, pro-Anglophile party, which is actually established by the financial establishment very close to London. These guys actually went through an upheaval where they dumped their leader, Malcolm Turnbull, in a very close vote, 42-41. Because he was pro-global warming, he was for this policy of putting a tax on carbon, he was for a, you know, going to Copenhagen with, you know, a policy for Australia to commit to carbon dioxide reductions and all these types of things. And what occurred was the population absolutely rejected this, and they pretty much burned the phone lines, you know, sent the email inboxes into meltdown of their political representatives because they did not want this. And in a sense, what you saw was, you know, what Lyndon LaRouche has described in the United States with the mass strike. You had down here such a pressure from the population not to support what these policies were for, you know, Copenhagen and tax on carbon, that it forced a massive upheaval in the Liberal Party. And it's interesting, just to have a look at what happened this past week. Well, they dumped Malcolm Turnbull, who's the leader of the Liberal Party. He's a former Goldman Sachs banker. He went to London earlier this year, I think in about July or August, and he came back committed to supporting the policy of our Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, to ram through in the shortest possible time targets and a treaty and policies to take to Copenhagen. On the basis of that issue, he was dumped, and they brought in a pretty conservative guy called Tony Abbott, who's a Liberal protege of John Howard. So what you see is there was a mass strike reaction. And the Liberal Party realized that if they did not dump their support for the Queen's policy and the British policy of, you know, carbon reduction and the genocide that includes, if they did not dump that, then the party would disintegrate because the population would revolt. And so you had this real irony, because this is supposed to be the party loyal to the Queen's intention. And just for a bit of extra spice in there, Tony Abbott, who's a arch monarchist, takes over the party from Turnbull, who's supposed to be ostensibly a Republican. So what we've seen is just complete irony. However, to add to this, I think it's important, the overhaul of the leadership of the Liberal Party meant that the Kevin Rudd and the Labor Party push for a carbon tax and the Copenhagen Treaty was defeated in the Senate, which means it was off the agenda. Our leader, Rudd could not take any policy to Copenhagen, and this is a consequence of and this is absolutely the case that our role, which the Citizens Electoral Council role and the LaRouche movement's role in Australia, has brought this about. If you go back and you look at the beginning of 2007, 2 years ago, more than 2 years ago, we made it a policy, of one of the frontline policies of our fight, to defeat the genocide agenda that lies behind global warming and this fraud of, you know, carbon dioxide reduction. And we mobilized that. We started putting out, we put out 500,000, so 500,000 copies of our regular newspaper called The New Citizen with the headline, Global Warming is a Fraud. And the way we approached this is we said, we have to educate the population. We have to show the population why this is completely a fraud and act on the population, because that is really what's going to make the difference in getting rid of this, you know, this tax and getting rid of this policy altogether. And so from there, we managed to then catalyze the screening. Our organizing managed to force the TV station here, our national TV station, to screen the Great Global Warming Swindle. And then through a process of continuing mass emailing and mass organizing around the country, we were able to shift the population to reject this this policy. And so, yeah, you see these developments in the recent few days as a consequence of, you know, really taking the fight to the population and telling the truth on this whole policy and what the outcome is intended to be. So, I mean, that's the short version.
Right. Well, let's, before we get to Tanu, maybe you could draw out one more point as to what kind of shift in strategic terms this is, because speaking of the Queen and the way the Liberal Party was loyal to her bidding, she was here in the American hemisphere at Trinidad and Tobago just 10 days ago, saying that there must be, at a 53-nation Commonwealth gathering, saying that there must be global warming agreements and forced pacts. So this goes directly against it, this Senate vote in Canada.
Yeah, absolutely.
So could you just add on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Queen came out and pretty much in Trinidad there gave this speech saying that, you know, we're the British Empire, or, you know, what they call the British Commonwealth today, has been at the center of policy in the world for the last several decades. And the Queen basically said, we must make sure that we not only continue to have such a strong influence on world affairs into the future, but we must expand our influence. We must make the issue of the empire global warming, and we must push for, you know, policies of genocide at Copenhagen, reductions of emissions and this type of thing. So this issue is the policy of the British Empire, of the Queen, that she had to personally come out and say the Commonwealth must take the lead on pushing for, you know, the whole policy on global warming of reduction in industry, reduction in development. And if you look at, you know, throw in there this this clown called Prince Philip, who says that if he were to be you know, born again or reincarnated, that he wants to come back to the earth as a virus to wipe out people. I mean, that captures the mindset of, you know, the British Empire. And the fact that she had to come out and say this publicly means that she's really desperate. And you see this desperation on these guys. And when you have inside the Commonwealth such a, well, inside the empire, so to speak, Australia and other nations sticking up the middle finger to the Queen, then, you know, you see there's that's what we're seeing, and it's really quite exciting.
Right. Congratulations.
Yeah,
we're having
good
a
job.
Good time here. Well, we want to come back on this, but Tanu, you have made the point frequently that the orientation, there's an intrinsic necessity about also going for just the opposite of genocide, going for the basis of increased population potential support by high technology in China elsewhere. Could you
absolutely
develop this now?
I think that the reason that the Copenhagen summit is going to fail is because of the fact that a major nation, as you know, Mr. LaRouche has pointed out, has made their shift towards the Asia Pacific at this point in time. I mean, they're making the shift. The shift is not complete. But there is a general understanding developing pretty deep-rooted between Russia, China, India, in particular, as of now, that the population location is Asia-Pacific, the requirements of developments are very high, and there is an enormous amount of capabilities that this area has developed over the years in vis-a-vis science and technology, manpower, skilled manpower, and all that, that it is, you know, that they have to make certain decisions and cannot depend on this kind of, you know, global monitoring operation, which has, you know, led to non-development and, you know, death of many people. So basically, you know, the Indian the nuclear program goes back to the 1950s. So that was long before the climate change became an issue. Nobody was talking about that in the 50s because India realized at that point in time that because of the large population and you know, limited resources, that every nation is limited, has limited resources, any nation of that kind of population size, that they will have to develop the capability, power generation capability, through a medium which does not require enormous amount of resources. So, but that is one side of it. The second side of it is that that source itself brings in a very high level of technology. This technology is not only your power generation technology, energy flux density, high energy flux density and all that, but also it brings in a lot of materials in there which otherwise you would never develop. And these material and the machine tool industry that comes with it provides the population an enormous tool to develop in many other areas. And as we have found out, and we have not done as well, but we have the capability, at least developed the capability, to use the nuclear power for not only power generation, but for, you know, for, you know, developing potable water. Because, you know, there is, when you have a large population, and you definitely, the first thing that is required for a large population is to secure food, to get a food security. And in order to have food security, you got to adopt the modern agricultural technology, which requires not only large amount of fertilizers but a lot of water. So you have to have enormous amount of capability to have water, and the water, you know, you cannot depend on rain-fed agriculture. It is not possible because, you know, a billion people's life depends on it. So you have to think about how to utilize the seawater, how to get the saline water converted into semi, or I would say minimally saline water, which can be used for agricultural purposes, and then also potable water for domestic and other commercial and industrial use. So nuclear energy comes in providing you with all these options, and there is no other single technology that exists which provides all these options simultaneously and also raises the skill level of the population. So there is, you know, anybody who has a little bit of insight and a little bit of foresight will immediately know that this is the only way a nation can survive. China, which of course is a civilizational nation, and although it did not adopt a developmental policy till 1979, 1980, but had already for its own military security had started looking at the nuclear technology, particularly its military strength. And but when you do that, you also have to do enormous amount of neutron science, neutron technology, and various other areas of power generation, which then can be fitted into in your future program for you know, nuclear power development. And they went in 1979-80, and they made it very clear. I still remember in 1989 that in Delhi, a international conference took place where No, I'm sorry. It's not 1989. It's Clinton administration. That is, must be after 92. It's 93, around 93, 94, that an international conference took place in New Delhi. And this thing was brought up that the global warming was not discussed, but carbon emission, carbon dioxide generation, greenhouse gases, all that stuff. And a whole bunch of, you know, the young scientists from United States, you know, sort of herded in by a Clinton administration guy who is connected with scientific advisory board of the president, went in there with an international conference. The Indians were there, Chinese were there, and many other nations were represented. And the Chinese went up, and I still remember, and Chinese scientist said, I agree with you. This greenhouse gas emission and all these are could be pretty dangerous and pretty difficult for us to remove, and which may cause a lot of money to you know, to remove those pollutions and all that. So we have decided that we'll go for nuclear. The moment he said that, I still remember that Clinton administration fellow, I don't remember his name exactly. He just put his hand on his forehead and said, "Oh my God!" So there's a kind of reaction, yes, in 19. But the Chinese had already that time had made up their mind that they will develop their power generation capability long term. Short term, in order to provide the people with food and job and things like that, they went for coal. And they will continue with coal and whatever else, gas and whatever else they can get their hands on, in order to provide, you know, raise the living standard and skill standard of the population. But for the long term, you know, they have made up their mind that, and they have seen it very clearly, that there is no other option for them but to go for nuclear technology. And that's going to use, and it is coming together, the recent caucus that India, China, Brazil, South Africa, Sudan also joined in that caucus, that took place last month, I think end of last month at Beijing, in which they decided that at the Copenhagen conference they will go in with they are not going to disrupt anything. But if any binding solution is proposed by the developed nations or any other nation, then they will jointly walk out. Now this strength, the basic understanding of this thing, comes from the fact that they have realized that the only way that their country will develop is nuclear. So, and the nuclear capability they'll have to develop by themselves. They'll have to develop the engineers, they have to develop the science, they have to develop the industry. And once they do that, then they really don't care what these, you know, international mafia, this climate mafia and all these people say. But at the same time, I must point out that the decision to go for, what I'm trying to get at, is the decision to go for nuclear was not based upon the fact that they are doing it in order to reduce the greenhouse gases or the global warming. It is a decision that this is the only way, and this is always, Mr. LaRouche has pointed out, a long time before, you know, anybody thought about climate change and global warming, that any nation who wants to be a powerful and an economically powerful nation and wants to provide the population the capabilities, they have no choice but to go nuclear. That's the only way they can go. And so that is what is basically the driving force behind and now these decisions that were made in China and India vis-a-vis nuclear. And I believe that in Asia-Pacific region, there are a lot of other countries are looking at it. Japan had already done it a long time back. Korea has already done it, South Korea. But also we are seeing some in Southeast Asia coming in, this thinking.
Right. And you had you wanted to say something on this, Glenn.
Oh, yeah. I was. It's interesting that Ramtanu mentioned this push, the response from China and India naturally to this, you know, attempt to force a reduction in, CO2, which is obviously for the British means, shutting down industry and going green with these terrible technologies like solar power and windmills and these ludicrous ideas, is they saw the necessity of going for nuclear. And it's interesting, in Australia, the recent break that's occurred has also forced the nuclear question back into discussion. Because if you're not going to support the Queen's plan, what kind of policy are you going to have in terms of long-term development? And what you've seen, what we've seen, is a few guys out of this upheaval have begun to say, well, look, the world is moving in a different direction to the types of ideas coming out of Copenhagen. We have to look at this question of nuclear and, see where Australia can move in that direction. Now, that's just a natural consequence of rejecting what comes as rejecting British policy, mm-hmm. is the nuclear the nuclear science, and this thinking is the alternative. This is the answer, and we're seeing that also in Australia as a consequence of this.
Right.
Right. I'm just pointing out here, we were just looking at a map, of an interactive map of the 400 power, mm-hmm. Nuclear power plants in the world, big, small, research or not. And of course, Australia stands out so vividly as empty.
Mm-hmm.
But so
it's a bit of America.
Yes, and with very little in Africa. By the way, I'll point out one thing here, and Tanu may add to this or not, that among the announcements, President Putin, when he was giving our prime minister, mm-hmm. He was giving the annual, he gives a right. kind of annual speech and question and answer. I think they get something like 2 million emailed questions. But it was announced that Russia is going to commit to 32 nuclear plants by when, Tanu?
Right. By 2000, in 10 years.
That is a mobilization.
That's a mobilization.
Or the beginning of a mobilization,
yeah.
rather than an indefinite,
yeah.
somewhat of a commitment. So,
I think that, Russian policy, Russia, of course, had 100% capability to develop every aspect of nuclear reactor and nuclear power. The most important thing for Russia at this point in time is to, and they're not a power short nation, the most important thing for Russia will be that what goes in the developmental policy, because 32 nuclear reactors, you can say approximately there will be about 32,000 megawatts of power. It will be in 10 years will be coming in, and that consumption of that power has to be connected with large-scale development of either, industries, manufacturing industries, or opening up new areas like Siberia and places like that. So it would be very interesting to note what their developmental policy vis-a-vis usage of this nuclear power is, because nuclear power by itself in Russia is not a novelty, which is, to many parts of the world it is. But for Russia, it is more important at this point in time because to develop its industrial capability strength, and then because Russia is one of the four power nations. And so Russia, the entire huge Siberian area development will bring about a sea change in the Eurasian landmass, and will also involve enormous amount of population involvement, because Russia by itself cannot develop Siberia. Russia doesn't have a population. Russia has a negative population growth. So it will has to involve, they have to involve Chinese and the Indians and others in order to develop this area. But in order to do that, the utilization of the power, the nuclear power that they'll be generating, it has to be seen how well it is being channeled and directed. If it is done in the right way, then basically what they would be going for is what Mr. LaRouche and basically the Schiller Institute had proposed on the Eurasian land mass development. It will be a very important part of the land, European Eurasian land mass development. I think that would be a very interesting thing to watch what comes up next in Russia's developmental program. Power generation is fine, but you know they are not a power short nation, so really they don't need, and their population is not growing up. So definitely these 32,000 megawatts will be utilized for very high power density required economic development. And that is one thing I'm very interested in.
Could we take a few minutes, and I'd like to ask both of you two follow-up questions on that. Mm-hmm. One thing is you've, Tano, you've, let me put them both out here. You've also, over the decades, sketched in for India what more the so-called landscape could look like if you were going for, which we are, mm-hmm. Smaller, modern, whatever you want to call them, fourth generation nuclear plants, what
right.
the geography of development would look like on the Indian subcontinent. And for you, Glenn, I know your Citizens Electoral Council has put out what kind of big projects in Australia would be part of the Pacific Basin development, but
right.
Tanu, on the Indian subcontinent.
Yes, I am very hopeful, and this is, of course, will come about with the help of the Russian cooperation, is basically the thorium breeder reactors. India has developed the very basics of the thorium reactors, and Indian design and is basically, thorium is not a fissile material, it's a fissionable material. That means thorium can be converted into fissile material. Therefore, in a thorium-232, when it gets hit by a neutron, it absorbs a neutron and becomes uranium-233, which is a fissile material. Now, to generate this uranium-233 from thorium-232, the old U.S. design, which was used in shipping port in 1960s, was basically use of particle accelerator to hit the thorium.
Shipping port was thorium in Pennsylvania?
Yes, yes.
That was Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and to make it into uranium-233. However,
in the 1950s, I think.
Yeah, 1960s, yeah. Early 1960s.
Okay.
And but in order to do large number of reactors, you cannot depend on the particle accelerator. So you have to develop a breeder reactor where thorium can be converted into uranium-233, while at the same time that breeder reactor is generating power. So India has developed that, and the demo reactor probably will go into action in next year, 2011. It should go into action. In the
Where
meantime,
is it, by the way?
It is in a place called Kalpakkam, which is in Tamil Nadu, in southern part of India. And Russians, on the other hand, also were quietly doing this thorium breeding process, and they have exactly at what level they are, we do not know. But with India in 2001, they signed a memorandum of understanding to broaden this area of cooperation in the thorium breeder reactor. Now, what I am looking at, and I think that which is of particular importance, and thorium is, and for all practical purposes, thorium is the best nuclear power generation fuel, because you know thorium is not fissile, but it's a thirsty fissionable material. That means it absorbs neutron very quickly. You know, the problem with U-238 or U-235 is that their cross section is so small that it doesn't really absorb neutrons. So you need quite a bit of effort, quite a bit of design in order to get into a geometry in which the neutron will be absorbed and the chain reaction will start. But thorium is a thirsty fissionable material, so it absorbs neutron very quickly. Secondly, it produces U-233, which has a very short half-life, which means it's highly radioactive, which means that it cannot be taken out by terrorists or anybody. There doesn't exist any protective material, protective stuff by which you can handle U-233 and can you can transport or anything like that. So from non-proliferation point of view, thorium is a natural product. And thirdly, thorium is the second largest naturally abundant resource, mineral resource on this earth. Number one is bauxite. So therefore, you know, thorium is a natural choice, but you know, uranium is uranium-235 is easy thing to do. And we did that. Now we have to go into this, you know, doing a little more difficult engineering, difficult neutron science to get this thorium thing done. And but once it is done, what I'm looking at is that we have to go into, the initial requirement was for the developed nations. The nuclear power was mostly for developed nations. And developed
decades ago.
Mm-hmm. And the developed nations have good grid system. That means you can hook into the grid system a very large nuclear reactor like 1,000 megawatt. Now, this development, the design of these grid systems are very complicated. It's like designing a water pipe distribution system. If you put in too much of power, it gets clogged. If that large input point suddenly go bust, then the whole system goes unstable. So therefore, you know, the grid system is very, very complicated, but if you have a very strong grid system through which thousands and thousands of megawatts of power are passing through on a regular basis, then you input a large reactor, it has a less possibility of creating any instability. But for a poor, in a developing nation, these grids are in a weak, and often the grids are not nationwide. And therefore, if you put in a large reactor, then the problem comes in that it's like, you know, putting in a 1-inch your main pipe, water pipe distribution system is a 1-inch pipe system, and you try to put in a 4-inch pipe and full of water into that main pipe distribution and the distribution pipe. So it will not go. It will not go. It will black out. So, therefore, one of the requirements for developing nations was to, there are two. One is that you have to develop a grid system which is big enough to absorb large input of power. And, you know, since the grid system often in a country like India or China, these are nationwide grid system, but it's weak. Development of grid system needs a lot of money, but it doesn't create any new power. Therefore, the tendency is basically is to generate power and the grid, do the grid system bit by bit by doing the grid system regionally. And then regional, you know, strengthening the grid regionally, then doing, and then connecting them up, you know. But the point is that in a developing nation like in India or Africa or even China, there is no requirement to develop this kind of huge grid. You can develop small reactors, and the small reactors are very useful. In the sense, it can be you know, if you have your grid will not be disturbed. B, you can locally consume that thing. For example, in the village, in the villages, you can put in a small 50 megawatt reactor, and that 50 watt reactor, you know, serves the village, and then the heat that it's, you know, that it creates can be used for, you know, flash desalinization of water. And then when the village becomes, you know, a little wealthier, you put in one or two more of these 50 and make a cluster. You can keep on making these clusters, and you can put as many as you want. And the good thing about it is that when you put in the first one, that is a 50 megawatt reactor, you need a very small infrastructure to make it work and very little capital expense. So you are introducing a very high technology with little capital expense, and in a, which doesn't need a huge infrastructure. So the whole thing can be put up in 1 or 2 years. It's a very, in my book, it's a very wonderful option that you have. And when I look at Africa, there is, you know, there is no way other than probably South Africa, any other part of Africa can absorb these large reactors. So the one of the things that the thorium reactors, since it is being developed in India and with the Russian help, or Russian collaboration, India must go for these small reactors. The small reactors will not only help India, but it will help a huge section of China and probably the entire Africa, because nobody in Westinghouse or in Hitachi, Toshiba or Areva, they would be interested to doing this small reactors, because selling one small reactor, you don't make any money. It's a 50 megawatt reactor and doesn't bring you any money. And until and unless you have a huge number of reactors in order, you do not go into that manufacturing line at all. You rather go with the 1,000 megawatt, and if you sell one, you make a substantial amount of money, which can be then channeled into more reactors and research work. So it is of utmost importance that those nations who are developing nuclear reactor technology at this point in time must think about this is the requirement of future, because the large population that are without power and without water, they will be served very well by these reactors. As I said, you can add clusters. You can add a 50 megawatt reactor and then a 300 megawatt reactor in the same cluster. It doesn't create any problem. So therefore, you know, this is one of the areas that, you know, we are pushing very hard in India to go for these small reactors in large scale. And in India's entire, if we look at India's entire southern peninsula, anything below the middle of India, there is really no river. The rivers are very short and they do not have enough water. So therefore, the only way that area can become what it should be is through the desalinization. And of course, power is always can be used, but it is the water which is the bottleneck for India's development in the southern peninsula. And nuclear power can serve that very well, and you can dot the entire coast with these little reactors. We'll be doing the desalinization and also will provide a little power which can be consumed by the local industries, small and medium scale industries that the area has or will have. So this, I think, in my thinking is that at this point in time, the British Empire's the biggest target, the largest target is Africa, because Africa has no option other than burning coal or burning any other kind of fuel. They don't have the nuclear capability, and they do not have any nuclear technology going anywhere in Africa. So with this climate change and the global warming and all this kind of thing, the first thing that will happen to Africa is that there will be, and already there is huge starvation. Starvation will be incorporated, it will be installed in perpetuity. And secondly, then whatever little money they generate out of selling their mineral resources, that will be then channeled into developing solar and wind power and things like that. Because then the argument will be the same that I am giving. The argument will be that since Africa doesn't have a grid to carry power, large amount of power, it must have local power generation and local consumption. And this power should be not be a large amount, but a small amount. And that's going to sustain the African way of life. And that will be the basic, that's the way the second green revolution that Kofi Annan and Bill Gates and people like that and talk about in Africa, they also suggest the same thing. There's an African way of life, which is basically otherwise say that you live your life with great in poverty, and do not worry about deaths, because that's the way of life in Africa. So I personally enjoy. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, enjoy underdevelopment. Don't place develop.
And that's your fate. That's your destiny. Now, the large nations like India and China and even Indonesia cannot afford to do that until unless they want to break up the country, their own country. So they have taken the decision that they have to provide for the population. And the only way they can do it is by adoption of nuclear and rejecting this, you know, climate change policies that are being, touted and imposed through this global mafia.
Well, I'll say, Glenn, the mention of thorium himself, and even though it's abundant around the world, it's handy in Australia. That's my understanding.
It's the number one reserve. Yeah.
Well, we, you know, down here we're a big island and we've got a lot of beaches.
Monazite.
Which is, monazite. We're very famous for our beaches, but we haven't been utilizing some of these great gifts that we have. And it has been, it's been the policy of the CEC and the LaRouche movement on this continent to, you know, bring Australia into an integration of development with the whole Pacific region. I mean, it really, this was the orientation coming out of World War II, where we had an alliance between Australia and the United States, what was known as the, you know, John Curtin, Franklin, Roosevelt partnership, was an intention to really get away from British colonialism and develop every region of the world. And John Curtin had that orientation, but unfortunately he passed away Franklin Roosevelt did. And, yeah, the British Empire was able to regroup itself and re-establish the influence over Australia through the green ideology, through the ideas of, you know, conservation and all these, you know, these terms which were, you know, came out of the eugenics movement, to pretty much keep people in a backward state without real development. Now, our movement has been pretty much combating this ideology, and the one thing that Australia has to do is really develop a solid nuclear industry to take the thorium in abundance in the sands of the beaches, and also to take the uranium, but not just to dig it out of the ground and send it off overseas for processing, which is the policy now under Rio Tinto and the British mining cartels, but to take these resources and establish here the types of manufacturing industries for reactor vessels to take the minerals and process and develop them here, and do it in such a way that you're going to integrate the whole of the nation, which, I mean, you're talking about developing high-speed rail corridors of the best, you know, modern rail systems to link our cities. You know, Australia is very large and very spread out, so you need the rail to integrate the system. And then what you actually need to do is we need to develop high-speed shipping in the north to get our, you know, our materials, our manufactured goods up there into the Pacific and into Asia, where this massive development is required. So there's a much that we've said on how we must develop all these things, and really, the break with the British is the key point. Being under the Commonwealth and being in the system under globalization, and which Australia has been stuck in for quite some time, it really is a challenge. The challenge on the plate now for us is to break with the British Empire of monetarism, to go with the traditions in our country, which are very deep, of a credit system as it's understood in the U.S. Constitution, is understood in from the work of people like Alexander Hamilton, the only way that you can go towards these types of economic programs is you've got to put this system in the grave where it belongs, and go with a system of cooperation with sovereign nations. And the first thing that you would do under an agreement like that amongst sovereign nations is cooperation on nuclear power development, because that will solve the water problems, it solves the energy problems, as Ramtanu was mentioning, with India and China and Africa. And The real challenge for us, if Australia is to be a developed nation, which is our cultural impulse, is we will be involved in and cooperate in that. And that's really our challenge. And that's why, I mean, we've got, I mean, we're producing the material to educate the population towards taking that Pacific orientation on themselves as a personal responsibility.
Let me put a plug in here for two things. Your website, you can correct me if it's wrong, is www.ceaust.com.au. That's www.ceaust.com.au.
And that's it, yep.
And the thing is that just to underscore, you have in tabloid form this multi-page New Citizen that's out for November and or October and November, I'm not sure, but that has mm-hmm. in the history from the history of Australia and the empire from that needs to be defeated from the vantage point you're just describing, right. From the development vantage point, going back to the 18th century. And it's terrific mm-hmm. reading. You're talking about using it like crazy as a tool in the midst of this upheaval in Australia, but right. other people will benefit yes. greatly by going to that. That's part of the. I hear you've had a big reaction to it when you started to get it in circulation.
Well, yeah. I mean, let me just say, on this New Citizen, this is it is a very historic document. The CEC, a team of us have been researching for the last 2 years the true history behind the founding of Australia, and really, this is absolutely important. As Lyndon LaRouche mentions all the time, that in every nation there's a deep-seated a cultural identity, and the most important thing that everyone must understand is the true history of their nation. And we in Australia, we've actually been lied to, and we've been told cover stories in the history class about the true reasons why the British Empire chose to colonize Australia. And just to give it some give a clearer picture of that, Australia came into existence pretty much on the following immediately after the American Revolution. And in the American Revolution, the British were completely bankrupt. You had, at the same time that the American Revolution was won, the independence of Ireland and a massive optimism spread through Europe. Republicanism and real optimism to get rid of this tyranny of empire and monarchy and all this, you know, medieval feudal system. And the British, being desperate, sent these Republicans, they gave them a bodgy trial for being, you know, treasonous and what have you, and they sent them off to Australia. But their real intention was to secure the British Empire in the Pacific. And one of the things that they were terrified about was, would Australia repeat the type of, you know, revolution that America just went through, which threw off this tyranny of oligarchism and this culture of feudalism and oligarchy, which they rejected. Australia in this way is unique, and this is what this newspaper goes through, is we were a nation that was founded without this subservience or this respect for, you know, oligarchism, which was embedded in European culture because of the optimism and because of the inspiration that the United States represented. And throughout our history, we've always had a very strong kinship with the ideas of the United States and its constitution. I'll just mention, for those who don't know, in Australia, we, in the beginning of the 1900s, had an American who came to Australia called King O'Malley, who pretty much successfully set up a national bank here in Australia, modeled explicitly on Hamilton. And he said that King O'Malley said, "I am the Alexander Hamilton of Australia," because no other figure in history could be improved upon in this question of economic policy. And through this, you had this massive influence of development programs inspired from the United States. And that's been the struggle in our whole history. This is what you're not taught in the classroom, obviously. This is what the British Empire and have tried to keep out of the minds of Australians and keep us in a state of being thinking small, thinking local, thinking isolated. This is why this new citizen is so powerful, because it's understanding that we share this common outlook that the United States does of that mankind is not an animal and just a sort of under the yoke of some form of oligarchy. And really we go through that, and we go through this the founding of Australia and how this culture was always fighting with the British Empire. And it really must be a lesson that Australians and people around the world understand, that to have this kind of orientation.
Yeah, I think that the climate crowd, the climate mafia, is basically rejected by anyone who has legs to stand up. And I think that they will be on the defensive. But the most important thing that is necessary for all the nations at this point in time, particularly, is that to put in place a nuclear a power generation program, which will, it's like in my book, like food security, it is what will keep the sovereign nation state intact. And that if we force that nuclear power generation in every country, you see the climate people will just vanish, because there is nothing to counter that, because it's such a strong argument that anybody can see through that why a nuclear power is necessary for a country's development, and not the power itself, but the nuclear power related technologies. Which will give them a long-term potential to develop and become a prosperous nation. So that should be the key, that, climate change is happening, so we'll go for nuclear, and we'll develop every bit from entire fuel cycle of nuclear and generation of and manufacturing of nuclear reactors, and that's what our goal is. And that itself will completely, put them in the, put them out in the sea, and they will not be able to do anything. And that's what is necessary at this point in time. I think so.
Right. And Tanu, it strikes me that the time period, you mentioned food security and food sovereignty for a nation, mm-hmm. that the exact time when India was collaborating with Dr. Norman Borlaug, the American, uh-huh. who was working with the nation of Mexico. So there was tri-nation development.
Right.
Mexico, the United States, and India. That was the period of interest in nuclear power in India.
Right.
The initiation and food sovereignty. So India did become, when? 1974?
I think by end of 1970s, they were already food sufficient at that time. And India's program was started in 1958. That was a very visionary nuclear scientist we had, Dr. Homi Bhabha, whose standard statement was, "No power is more expensive than no power." he never would pay any attention, and he basically convinced the authorities that you cannot look at nuclear power as a capital expense. It is the building block of a nation. And you know, not only nuclear power has power, it can create water, it has got radioisotopes, which are used in industries all over, nuclear medicine. You are bringing in a host of you know, developments with through use of one technology, which is, in my book, is extremely, you know, of great use to every nation.
Gentlemen, our time has come to an end. We'll resume
soon. Could I add one thing to this?
Yes, talk quite fast. We're over the hour, and go right ahead, okay. Glenn. Go right ahead.
Cool. Well, I think that there's going to be this coming week, in light of these developments, the leader of the Citizens Electoral Council in Australia here, Craig Isherwood, National Secretary, is going to be giving his first national webcast address to organize the population and get them on board.
Give us the time and place and the website again.
It'll be, for us, December 10th at 7 p.m. It will be available on our website, www.ccaust.com.au. And I don't know what that is, America time.
16 hours.
That will be
earlier.
4 a.m. on December 10th.
Okay. But well, then we'll look forward to have good luck. This is very good news.
Wonderful.
And December 12th, we resume here with the LaRue Show, 3 o'clock to 4 Eastern Time in the United States. And I hope to have Harley Schlanger as host of one of the newly announced candidates in the United States to get rid of the likes of people like right. Nancy Pelosi. That would be Summer Shields in the Pacific state of California. Thank you, Glenn Isherwood, Ramtanu Maitra. This is Marcia Mary Baker. I'm sorry to sign off, but it's been December 5th, 2009. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thanks.